of our thinking verses 9 through 14, as we think about the subject, the power of praising your name. Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 9, and study through verse 14. Solomon writes, I have prepared you since my love to my feeling of Pharaoh's chariot. Receive the love of the Lord to net the chains of gold. We will make the orders of gold and stud and silver. While he is at his table, my fire sent forth his fragrance.
And a sense of worth by the time involved and the particular messages that we deliver. It's repetitive. Nature is crucial. A spoken word. Number three, expression of high value. This involves our passing along a message to others that affirms their worth and value as a person, and they write, praising them as valuable is the key idea. So, a meaningful touch, the spoken word, expression of high value. Number four, picturing a special future. And though we have in mind primarily during our study of the Song of Solomon, marriage, this one is particularly relevant when we think in terms of our relationship with our children. They write, this is the uniquely prophetic aspect of the blessing. What do our words tell others we believe the future holds for them? How do our present descriptions or nicknames of others lay the foundation for future attitudes and actions on their part? How often it is that children fulfill the earlier expectations and predictions of a parent or friends for good or bad. Positive words of encouragement as to future possibilities are those which will bless rather than curse. And then number five, an active commitment to see the blessing come to pass. They write, this characteristic is both Godward and manward. Godwardly, we are to commit others to His blessing and will. But manwardly, we are personally to make the commitment to spend whatever time, energy, and resources necessary in order that we might bless others. Now, when I think through their list, what I discover is something along these lines. First of all, blessing other people has to do both with what I say and also with what I do. My words are important, but my actions also matter as well. And furthermore, what I say and what I do in the context of being a blessing cannot be occasional, it must be constant. Furthermore, as we're going to see tonight as we examine the Song of Solomon, my blessings that I extend to my mate should be specific, they should be sacrificial, and yes, it is even appropriate for them to be sensual. Now you might ask me, where do you get those ideas, and particularly that last one? Well, again, I think we're going to see this evening, they arise naturally out of these five verses in Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 9 through verse 14. And in particular, as we see the idea of being sacrificial, of being specific, and being sensual, we will see that there is enormous power in praising our mate. Now, if that is indeed true, how is it that we ought to be about the business of blessing one another and praising one another in this way? You see in the outline provided this evening, three major ideas that I believe, again, come right out of the text. Number one, we should be specific in our praise. We should be specific in our praise. We have previously seen the scene of the simple world of the shepherd. That was what we saw in verses 5 through 8. Now we shift to the scene of the splendid world of the Egyptian Pharaoh. We have seen already that the Shulamite woman has some insecurities. She has some areas that cause her particular concern, and one of them is her appearance, and the other is whenever Solomon is absent or away from her. He is a sensitive male, which is a rarity. His antenna is up, and he is picking up these vibes from his lover, from his bride-to-be, and so he immediately recognizes that she needs words, she needs actions, she needs him to bless her, affirm her, and tell her, at least from his perspective, that she is the very best. And so he is specific in his praise. First of all, he tells her she is special. Look at it there, verse 9. I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. First of all, notice twice the use of the possessive pronoun, my. I have compared you, my love. The NIV translates it, I think, even better. I have compared you, my darling. Now, this is the first time we find Solomon using this phrase in this book, but it will not be the last. 9 times in the Song of Solomon, he will refer to her as his love or his darling. He does it here in chapter 1, verse 9. He does it again in chapter 1, verse 15, chapter 2, verse 2, chapter 2, verse 10, chapter 2, verse 13, chapter 4, verse 1, chapter 4, verse 7, chapter 5, verse 2, and chapter 6, verse 4. 9 times, repeatedly, again and again and again and again, he tells her that she is his love, she is his darling. Unlike her brothers, who in verse 6 had hurt her, Solomon is intent on treating her with tender, loving care. By calling her his love, his darling, he is expressing to her, I will be your provider, I will be your protector, I will be your lover, but I will also be your friend. She is near and dear to his heart. But then Solomon does something that I need to warn any man tonight, that if you go out from this place tonight and you do this very same thing to your wife, you will probably find yourself in a hole from which you will never, ever extricate yourself. He compares her to a horse. Now, guys, some of you are old enough to understand this. Your wife will not be impressed if you go home tonight and say, honey, you remind me of Mr. Ed. It's not going to go over well. She is not going to respond in the way that the Shulamite woman did, because it's a different context. But what we do need to understand is, though you and I are horrified at the thought of a man telling a woman, you look like a horse, in that day, she would have been greatly, greatly honored. And furthermore, when you look at it in its historical context, the praise that he heaps upon her with this picture is absolutely phenomenal. He says, I have compared you, my love, to my, there's a possessiveness here, my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Now, what is going on here? Well, first of all, we need to understand, Pharaoh's chariots were not pulled by fillies. Pharaoh's chariots were pulled exclusively by stallions. So what he is saying in essence is this: you are like the only female in a world of males. If the whole world was nothing but men, in comparison, it is as if to me, you are the only woman on the planet. Now, of course, he is also, I think, being somewhat sensual, because obviously, if a filly comes trotting up amidst a bunch of stallions and male horses, she would cause quite a commotion. She would be greatly noticed. Indeed, her value to those stallions would be inestimable. And in the same context, that's exactly what he is saying to her. You're utterly priceless. You're like the only woman in a world of men. Not only would I desire you, all men would desire you, yet unbelievably, you're not their filly. You are my filly. Like the only woman in a world of men are you to me. Indeed, he says to her, you are very special. But now, secondly, he also says to her, you are very beautiful. For he says in verse 10, your cheeks, they are lovely with ornaments, and your neck also with chains of gold. Now here, Solomon focuses very specifically on an area of insecurity, her looks. He tells her, your cheeks are lovely, they are beautiful. He goes on to describe the jewelry that is coming down from her ears that are like dangling earrings, or the ornaments and jewelry that comes down alongside of her face. And he says, you're gorgeous. These things enhance your beauty. Furthermore, your neck is also beautiful with chains or strings of jewels. Now, when he speaks of her neck in this kind of a way, he is probably saying there's something about you that is stately, There's something about you that is regal. There is something about the way you carry yourself that indeed communicates marvelous dignity and worth and value from your very person. Now, it is true, he may still have the imagery of the horses in his mind, for we do know from archaeological studies that the ancient horses, the great chariots that were pulled by these great stallions, would often have beautiful decorated jewelry and elaborate other type of things that would be around their faces and down their necks. Yet I am convinced he is no longer thinking about those horses. I think rather now he looks at her and he in essence says, I am somewhat mesmerized by your beauty. As I gaze upon you, I find that you are lovely, and I find that you carry yourself in a marvelous and dignified way. And I think he would even say this: the jewelry that adorns you does not distract, nor does it detract at all, but rather it enhances your appearance. One commentator said, in looking at this verse, Solomon is not looking at some overdressed, glittering Christmas tree. And she's not. She doesn't wear too much. What she wears simply enhances the natural, simple beauty that is there by virtue of who she is as a woman. And Solomon says, in his opinion, she has absolutely no equal. He praises her specially. He praises her concerning her beauty, and he tells her with specific words how attractive he finds her. Now, we need to be reminded tonight, not only from Song of Solomon, but also as we noted a moment ago from Gary Smalley and John Trent, that our words are powerful weapons. Sometimes we say the little ditty, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names or words will never hurt me. But we all know that's not true. It's absolutely not true. If you get close enough to me, you will discover I have a scar under my eyebrow. My cousin hit me in the eye with a baseball bat when I was about 5 years old. If you get right here, you'll see a scar on my right ear where my brother body slammed me on Mama's marble coffee table one day when we were wrestling when she was not at home. And to this day, she still does not know how that crack got in her marble coffee table. I may be 43. I'm still not going to tell her. If you get right here, you'll see a scar where, when I was in high school playing football my junior year, we were preparing for a big game one Friday night, and I was a defensive back. And what we would do to kind of get your juices flowing before a game is we would play bull in the ring. But the particular type of bull in the ring was you got to be in the middle, you got to point at people, and you got to go up and pop them in the chest, and it just kind of got your juices flowing. Well, I had gone earlier, and I did not mean to, but I hit one of my friends, and I stood up, and I hit him in the chin, and it hurt. And this friend of mine is very revengeful, and unfortunately, he came after me, and so when it was his turn, I knew it. The first person he pointed to was right at me. I put my head down like this, just as tight as I could, but he came up, and he hit me in the chest and slid that helmet up, and he slit my chin right there, and blood went everywhere. Now, folks, I want to tell you something. This, this, and this, all three of those things hurt, and they hurt badly. But none of them hurt as badly or as painfully as I have felt when some people have hurled certain words at me at various times in my life. And nothing is more important to the health of a marriage than that the right kind of words be hurled from one spouse to another. Steve Stevens, who is a marriage and family speaker, says, and I quote, "A healthy marriage is a safe haven from the everyday tensions of life. We need to hear positive things from our mate." He then surveyed a number of friends, and they came together and collaborated, and they came up with a list entitled 37 Things We Should Say to Our Spouse. Listen to the list that these couples came up with. "Good job. You are wonderful. That was really great. You look gorgeous today. I don't feel complete without you. I appreciate all the things you've done for me all these years. You come first in my life, before the kids, my career, our friends, anything. I'm glad I married you. You're the best friend I have. If I had it to do all over again, I'd still marry you. I wanted you today. I missed you today. I couldn't get you out of my mind today. It's nice to wake up next to you. I will always love you. I love to see your eyes sparkle when you smile. As always, you look good today. I trust you. I can always count on you. You make me feel so good. I'm so proud to be married to you. I'm sorry. I was wrong. What would you like? What is on your mind? Let me just listen. You are so special. I can't imagine life without you. I wish I were a better partner. What can I do to help? Pray for me. I'm praying for you. I prize every moment we spend together. Thank you for loving me. Thank you for accepting me. Thank you for being my partner. You make every day brighter. And with words of praise like that, words that are absolutely specific and particular, we build up, we don't tear down. We bless, we don't curse. And indeed, in the context of marriage, we create an environment of romance, which is absolutely essential for building the intimate aspects of our relationship. So we should be specific in our praise. But now, secondly, we should also be sacrificial in our praise as well. Solomon's praise in verse 9 and verse 10 now inspires others to praise the Shulamite woman as well. In other words, what you and I say publicly about our mate often influences the opinion of others about our mate. If we're always putting our mate down, others will tend to think negatively of them as well. But if we're praising them, building them up, complimenting them, then it will not be by accident. Other people will likewise have a very high opinion of them. Solomon said to her, you're special, you're beautiful, you're the best, you deserve the best. He has done it not just in words, but now with the Jerusalem chorus coming in, this group of ladies coming in, we also see that she is now also praised and also blessed in sacrificial action. Now again, how should we be sacrificial in our praise? Number one, we should be specific. And number two, we should be sincere. Look at verse 11. We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. Now, that's a very simple phrase. I don't read more into the text than we ought to, but let me tell you what Mortier said in his free translation and free paraphrase of this verse. We will crown you with more royalty, O maiden queen, with costly gems, with rings of golden sheen and sparkling spikes of silver. In other words, she is worth a costly, she is worth a sacrificial kind of praise, a sacrificial kind of giving. He is not just going to praise her with his words. He is also going to praise her with his actions. And I guarantee you, it is going to affect, and it is going to influence, and it is going to help her grow into the kind of woman that will honor God and also the kind of woman that will be a wonderful blessing to him. Socrates, the ancient Greek philosopher, said, by all means, marry. If you get a good wife, you'll become happy. If you get a bad one, you'll become a philosopher. Well, I am convinced the issue is not so much getting a good wife as it is a man gaining a good wife by the way he treats her and by the way he loves her, by the way he cares for her. And guys, women love specific and particular and creative ideas. It just blows them away when you and I get into the nitty-gritty details of blessing them. Many times when I do marriage conferences, I will kind of get on the guys and kind of fuss at them a bit. And so a lot of times I hear these horror stories that come back to me that the guys will leave the conference, and so they'll go home with their wife and they'll do something like this. They'll say, well, honey, why don't we go out on a date Friday night? Well, she's just blown away. Well, they haven't had a date in, you know, the last decade, and so she's pretty impressed. And he says, yeah, we'll go out on a date Friday night. And so her heart begins to beat rather rapidly and her palms begin to sweat and her pulse increases and she says, well, darling, what are we going to do? And the dumbest, stupidest, most ignorant words possible come out of the mouth of that man. Oh, it don't matter to me. And you know what that says to her? It doesn't matter to you. It doesn't matter that she cares. It doesn't matter that she wants. All you're doing is trying to make up for being a sorry husband because you went to a marriage seminar, and once this date's over, there'll be no more. And in fact, this one means so much to you, you don't give a flying rip what we do. And then you don't understand why she says, well, it doesn't matter to me whether we ever go out or not. And you say, well, she just is hard-hearted. No, you're just a stupid idiot. I mean, your brain is not functioning very well. There's a lot of gray matter up there that's at least dormant, if not in digression. And guys, women are not impressed with generalities. And if you look at all of this, he has been very specific. He's commented her, comparing her to a beautiful filly. He's talked about her cheeks. He's talked about her neck. Now she is getting ornaments of gold and silver. He is very precise and very specific in the way that he loves her, and he has done so now sacrificially. Yes, he is specific, but he is also sincere. As I read through these verses, I get no indication that Solomon is trying to bribe her or buy her off. His desire is indeed to bless her, and bless her in a way that will speak to her heart. I think one of the finest books that has come out in the last probably 10 years when it comes to helping married folks get along well is the book by Gary Chapman entitled Love Languages, The Five Love Languages. Because in that book, Gary basically says, look, we can really kind of boil all of life down to five love languages, and we all have them. We all have them. We have at least one of them, and maybe we have even two or three of them. Nobody has them all. And furthermore, what happens to be the love language of your mate is probably not your love language. It is very rare that two people have the same love language. Now you say, well, what are these five love languages? Well, you can summarize them under five words. Number one, words. Words. Now specifically, he says words of affirmation, but words. Number two, gifts, or the receiving of gifts, but gifts, words, gifts. Number three, service, specifically acts of service, but service. Number four, time, time. Number five, touch, touch. So words, gifts, service, time, touch. Now, let me just be personal for a moment. In our marriage, it's real clear to me that Charlotte has two love languages. Her love languages are gifts and time. If I ever want to, you know, hit a grand slam with her, I just bring her a gift. It doesn't have to be very expensive. It can be something very small and, from my perspective, insignificant. But the fact that I would stop somewhere and buy this thing for her and then bring it to her speaks volumes to her heart. She also loves for me to spend time with her and to be with her. I think in some ways it may be for her a reflection of her upbringing. My wife, as some of you would know, grew up in a home where her daddy and her mother were both alcoholics. When she was six, they divorced. When she was eight, she and her brother and sister were placed in the Georgia Baptist Children's Home where she lived from the time she was nine until she was 18. She has shared with me, not too often, I don't think she wants to speak about it a great deal, but she has shared with me that she had some pretty unimpressive birthdays and Christmases while she was living at home. And even though once she went to the children's home, she always got things for her birthday and she always got things for Christmas, she never got anything from Mama and Daddy. And you know, it's just not the same. And I'm grateful for what we do when we minister to children's homes. And I want to quickly add, as traumatic and as painful as all that was, one great thing happened to Charlotte when she was in the children's home, and that was when she was about 11. She trusted Jesus Christ as her personal Lord and Savior at a Baptist church, and she never went to church with her mother and dad. And so out of all that bad and all that horror and all that sadness, God did do some good things. But I think because of that, you know, it's meaningful to her, for those that she is intimately related, those that she's in close relationship, to be there. And secondly, I think also it matters a great deal to her that gifts come from those that are close to her and that love her. So gifts and time are her love language. Well, they're not mine. No. My love languages are praise, words, and touch. You see, I wear a ring and an Iron Man stopwatch. And I'll wear this suit until there are holes in it. I don't need to have another suit. In fact, I've got too many suits now. I can't make up my mind which one to wear. And I'm just not, you say, well, why'd you buy them all? I didn't buy any of them. No. Who has the love language of gifts? Charlotte. Who do you think bought all those suits? Charlotte. I got a gazillion ties. I didn't buy any of them. I went with Al Mohler. Now, Al Mohler's got the love language of gifts, but I was with him yesterday, and he's buying a pulley bag, and he was looking at ties, and I just want to go home and drink a milkshake and watch Atlanta Braves. That's all I wanted to do. But he wouldn't take me home. He's driving around, you know, going to the adult toy store, you know, the mall, and he's just looking at all these kind of things and stuff. Well, I don't think that way. I think in terms of praise, words, and touch. I love for people to say nice things about me, and I love to be touched. Now, my wife is good at touching me at all sorts of places, but in particular, I'm going to keep it where it needs to be, all right? Don't you get worried now. Tell Brother Kevin he's all right. Folks, I love to have my feet rubbed. I love foot massages. When I get to heaven, I've already put in a request for two angels, one for the left foot and one for the right foot, and they're going to massage my feet for all of eternity. That's going to be heaven to me as long as and being with Jesus, that's all I need. Jesus and my left and right foot rubbed, and I'll be happy for eternity. Well, my wife knows this, and my wife is not above, like most wives, manipulation and seduction. And so one night, she came up to me, and she said, honey, there's a movie that I would like for you to watch with me called Sense and Sensibilities. Now, some of you ladies may know this movie. Some of you guys may also know it. First of all, that's about the stupidest title for a movie I've ever heard, okay? Sense and Sensibilities. I knew that this was not going to be an action-packed blockbuster. I was very much aware of that from the title. And so I begin to do what a man is really good at doing, and I begin to make excuses about why I just did not have the time that I could commit to her to watch this movie with her. And you know what? She didn't argue with me. She didn't fight with me. She simply said, okay, and as she was walking away, she said, you know what, I really feel bad for you. I said, why? She said, well, you're going to miss out on a two-hour foot rub along with the movie and the popcorn. My response was simply this, what time does the movie start? Now, folks, she knows how to speak to my heart because she knows that that is a means whereby she speaks my love language. And I think Solomon had been watching this bride-to-be, and he had come to understand that being specific, being sincere, and speaking in a way that would talk to her heart would indeed let her know of his love. And so he was sacrificial as well as specific in his praise. But now, number three, it is also appropriate for us to be sensual in our praise as well. Solomon was the one speaking in verse 9 and verse 10. The daughters of Jerusalem joined in with him, I would argue, in verse 11. Now it is the Shulamite woman's time to respond. And what you see is really beautiful. What you see tonight and what we'll see all of next week is a contest. A contest to see who can outpraise and who can outbless and who can outlove the other. He's praised her. She's going to fire back and praise him. He'll come back in verse 15. She'll fire back in verses 16 and 17. He'll come back in chapter 2, verse 2. She'll come back in chapter 2, verse 3. And back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, they will try to see who can bless and praise and love the other more. And of course, what happens but that they both wind up being wonderfully blessed, wonderfully loved, and wonderfully satisfied. Now, being sensual in our praise, Solomon says three things. Number one, desire is made known by love. Tell him he is worthy of an expensive display. She says there in verse 12, while the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. Again, she has addressed him as a king. Of course, this may be a literal designation given the fact that Solomon is the author of the book, but throughout the book, I do believe there is the motif that the man is the king and the woman is the queen. And she does indeed view him as her king, and he looked at her as his queen, as his princess. So I think she addresses him in this way to praise him, to build him up, to affirm him. Now, the fact that he is sitting at the table speaks of the fact that he is at a time of rest, He is a time of relaxation. He is a time of rejuvenation. I do think the Shulamite woman recognizes that at the most bedrock basic needs of a man, one of them is a need for home support and serenity. A man really does need to have a home that is his castle where he can retreat and know that he will be strengthened and he will be cared for and he will be able to be rejuvenated and made strong for the battle of the next day. And so he is sitting at his table, and while he is, she begins to make movement toward him. She begins to approach him, and before he sees her, he smells her. My spikenard, my perfume, sends forth its fragrance. Now, what is spikenard? Well, it is an expensive perfume. And I did a little research in preparation for this message and discovered, I did not know this, that spikenard is native to the Himalayan mountain regions of India. So for spikenard to make its way from the mountains of India all the way to Israel would, of course, taken great difficulty and therefore would make this unbelievably scarce, unbelievably expensive. And so this exotic fragrance was very much in demand, and indeed throughout the ancient world it was viewed as an erotic love potion. And so she is expressing her sensual feelings and sensual desires towards Solomon. She appeals to his self-worth. She calls him a king, but she also appeals to his sense of smell, and she acknowledges that she herself is aroused and wishes to elicit the same from him. He is her king, and he is therefore worthy of a sensual and expensive display of affection. I wonder how he must have responded as she approached him in this kind of a way. Desire is made known by love. Tell him he's worthy of an expensive display. But now number two, desire is also made known by loyalty. Tell him he is a fragrance close to your heart. In genuinely and truly erotic tones, the woman says there in verse 13, a bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me. Double possessive there. My beloved to me that lies all night. Third possessive pronoun in verse 13, that lies all night between my breast. One translation said it this way, her beloved is a bundle, a sachet of myrrh that lies all night between her breasts. Myrrh was a resinous gum gathered from a species of South Arabian tree. In liquid form, it could be carried in a bottle, but that's not what they did. They would take this myrrh, and they would mix it together with fat, and they would make it into a solid. And then they would put it in a little pouch or a little cloth that would hang around the neck, because understand, it's very hot in Palestine. And the means of hygiene were nothing like they are today. And you just couldn't run over and take a shower real quickly anytime you wanted to. So what would you do to make sure that you maintained a pleasant smell to those that were around you? Well, one of the means whereby they did this was they would take this myrrh, they would put it in a little sachet, put it around their neck, and it would lie here, yes, for a woman, between her breasts, and as she would get hot, and as it would lie against her body, and her body temperature would rise, it would melt, and it would give out then this very fragrant and attractive and beautiful smell. Indeed, as one man said, as the fat melted from the body heat, the aroma of the myrrh would fill the entire room. Now, what she is doing here is saying, Solomon, that's what you are to me. You are like that sweet-smelling bundle that, yes, lies all night between my breasts. Now, of course, what is close to the breast but the heart of a woman? And so what she is saying is that throughout the night, I am at peace, I am at rest, I am secure, because the love of my life lies right next to my heart, right between my breasts, in a very intimate, very sensual, and indeed a private place that is reserved for no other man but you. And so there's unbelievable loyalty that is communicated as she talks about him being in this kind of very precious and tender relationship with her. But now number three, desire is also made known by longing, and our pastor asked me to comment on this, so I will. Tell him he is refreshing like an oasis in a desert. Verse 14, my beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms like those in the vineyards of in Gedi. Again, Shulamite refers to Solomon as her lover. Theirs is an exclusive love relationship. Throughout the book, it is clear Solomon is a one-woman kind of man, and Shulamite is a one-man kind of woman. He is secure in his relationship with her. She is secure in her relationship with him. That is why they can give themselves sexually and romantically and sensually in the way that they do, for they have no fear at all that there will be betrayal or disappointment. Now, she says here, he is refreshing like a cluster of henna blossoms or henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. Again, I did some research because I don't know what a henna bloom is, and so I discovered that, first of all, it's really a bush that can grow as high as 10 feet. It has thick, white, and yellow flowers that come together in clusters, and they have a smell that is very similar to that of a rose. Now, they don't just grow everywhere. And in fact, if you've ever been to Palestine and you move south of Jerusalem, you're in the desert, and you won't find them virtually anywhere except one place. The oasis just to the west of the Dead Sea, just south of Jerusalem and just north of Masada, a small oasis that has a beautiful waterfall called En-Gedi. And what is she saying here? She is saying, in essence, something like this. When I look at the world of men, all I see is a desert. Now, that's not very impressive to men, is it? But then she says, but when I saw you, I didn't see a desert. I saw an oasis. And not just an oasis that would sustain me and that would support me, but I saw an oasis full of pleasures and sweet and beautiful things that attracted me to it. He has said to her, you're like the only female in a world of men, the filly compared to the stallion. She turns the same kind of a praise around with a different analogy. She says, the world is nothing but a desert. Then came you. And when you showed up in my life, suddenly amidst the desert of all the men, and you know what? Maybe she's even thinking back somewhat to the way she'd been treated by her brothers. It is interesting to note that her father is never mentioned in the book. I will not read into that more than I ought. But it does seem to be the case that until now, there's really been no man in her life that has treated her with love and respect and honored her like he has. And so in a sense, she could say, all of my life has been kind of life in a desert. And then you stepped into my life and suddenly it was like a beautiful, wonderful oasis. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. What passion indeed flows forth when we praise our mate and we praise them in the kind of a way we've seen described this evening in the Song of Solomon. Tommy Nelson, who's written a wonderful book on the Song of Solomon called The Book of Romance, says simply this: kindness is a mark of respect, and respect is absolutely necessary for there to be romance. We've seen respect from Solomon to Shulamite, from Shulamite back to Solomon, and indeed we've seen the kind of passion and the kind of romance that arises when we are faithful in praising our mates. Now, one of the things that I've discovered is this: for us to be able to praise them, we've got to know them. And for some of us, we're way down the road in that, aren't we? Yet we would all be honest, I think, and acknowledge you never can know your mate too well. You can never know your mate too much. But unfortunately, in the day in which we live, far too many people get into the marriage relationship, and in actuality, they don't really know each other at all. Now, that may not apply to you, but I'm willing to wager that everybody here tonight knows somebody that may apply concerning. So in the notes that I provided for you, I have given you on page 3, page 4, and page 5 a premarital inventory. And this is a tool that I use when I do premarital counseling so that I can begin to understand some things about the background and about the general makeup and inclinations of the man and also of the woman. And indeed, I think any couple would be foolish if they did not at least pursue some type of premarital counseling and premarital inventory that would indeed raise some questions that probably would never be raised until they're once in the wedding or once into the marriage. And then it's a little too late to find out if there is major incompatibility and major dysfunction. It's a whole lot better to find that out in advance. And so one of the things, again, I would emphasize is we praise them best when we know them best. And so one of the things you have here in your notes that perhaps will be helpful to you, perhaps it will be helpful to someone else, is a premarital inventory that just raises some questions. And you know what? Even for those of us who have been married for a while, when you look down, for example, on page 3 at number 2, the man, and you ask men this question, what attracted you to your fiancé? What was it that first caused you to move in her direction? What are the 3 most important qualities that you saw in her, or if you're now considering marriage, that you see in her now? And as you think about what you need as a man, what are the 3 most important qualities you would like to find in your wife? And I ask the same question from the woman's perspective about the man. And you know what? Even if you've been married 10, 20, 30, or 50 years, you would not be ill-served to consider those questions and to see what answers you might get. But I close with a wonderful statement by a former president, Abraham Lincoln. He said on page 5, the success of a marriage depends not only on having the right partner, but also in being the right partner. And I would submit to us this evening that from Song of Solomon chapter 1, 9 through 14, we understand that the right partner is a praising partner, one who indeed looks for the best in their mate. And once they find it, they tell them so. You let me close this with prayer. Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for the beauty of this love poetry. And I thank you, Lord, that Solomon would look into the eyes of his bride-to-be and say to her, you're the only woman for me. In fact, it's like you're the only woman in the whole wide world as far as I'm concerned. And that the bride, Shulamite, would turn around and say to him, well, my life in many ways has been much like a desert, very dry, very difficult, very painful. When I looked out across the horizon, there were days and weeks and months and years where I saw nothing hopeful. And then God brought you into my life. And Lord, I suspect that tonight there are a number of us that could indeed give such a testimony about our own mate. Oh, maybe it wasn't as bad as it was for the Shulamite woman. But when you brought this special person into our life that is now our mate, our lover, our friend, it was indeed a special day, a wonderful day. Indeed, our life has never been the same because of what you did on that occasion when you brought the two of us together. We praise you for that. We thank you for that. We acknowledge that you are indeed the Lord of all things, including our marriage, our family, and our home. And we want to honor you. And we want to do marriage and do romance and just do all of these things that come about when we do join our lives to another. We want to do it, Lord, in a way that is honoring to you and consistent with your revealed word.